call the conference committee to order, even though we're absent one of our, a couple of our members. We just finished the floor session, so hopefully they will appear. I know one of our members has a conflict with the bill hearing, so we'll begin on our continued comparison of House File 934 and Senate File 1030. The I think we were done with the spreadsheet on the spending, with the exception of the department. Do you have any new spreadsheets that we could that include that, or
Mr. Chair or Madam Chair and members? I think a new spreadsheet was duplicated today. Yeah, maybe if we could have the pages, give them to the Senate members.
I don't know that I have one, but
it should be April 12th, 6:25 p.m. in the upper left-hand corner.
I don't have anything like that. This was on my desk, so I don't know where they...
The page is bringing one up.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Chair, the
thank you, Mr. Crow.
Agency budget starts on line 196 on the second to the last page, or third to the last page.
Okay, thank you.
And both the House and Senate bills have a reduction on line 206 to the agency's operating budget. The House reduction is about $6 million per year, which is about a 30% per year reduction.
And Madam Chair and members, on line 206, the Senate reduction is about 15% on line 206 for a savings of $5.9 million. In addition, on line 2.7, the Senate had $10,000 cost, reflecting the cost associated with rulemaking for the non-public pupil homeschool provision. And on line 208, the Senate paid for rulemaking on the alternative teacher program that was passed earlier in the session. Flipping to the next page on line 209, the Senate also paid for an FTE associated with the Early Graduation Achievement Program Administration. It buys a Education 2 employee. And Madam Chair and members, I'll skip down now to line 217. This is the Minnesota State Academies. Both bills take the reduction that was recommended by the governor associated with restructuring the food service program at the Minnesota State Academies. That saves $309,000 a year. Madam Chair, members, I'll mention the Senate's position quickly on the Purpich School. The base budget is reduced by $500,000 a year. That's about 7%.
Madam Chair and members, on line 229 to 231, you see the conversion of the Purpich School to a charter school that was mentioned up in general ed, where we showed the additional pupils in the gen ed system because of the conversion. Line 229 is the elimination of the annual appropriation beginning in fiscal 13 for the Purpich School. There are severance costs upon converting the school, because the employees of the Purpich School are state employees and are subject to severance provisions. And then line 231 shows the ongoing costs for the Department of Administration to manage the facility, to basically maintain it, and that's about $350,000 a year. And there's an additional $100,000 in fiscal 13 that would fund the sale, the cost of the sale of that facility, and so that's available until it's spent. So the $350,000 would end whenever the facility was sold. And, Madam Chair, I think that concludes the agencies, and we can move to the levies if there aren't any questions.
Are there any questions on the state agency portion? Not? Okay. Who's going to take the levy?
Madam Chair, we'll trade off again. Maybe I just will describe how the levy sheet is slightly different from the aid sheet. The first grouping of columns is fiscal 12 and 13. Because we are already in calendar year 2011, which is when levies are paid for fiscal 2012, there won't be any changes to that first column. So the first column, FY12, always stays the same. Then FY13, you see there are, and later years, there's a column that says certified estimate, which is the estimate of the amount of property taxes that will be certified in each category. The house amount of projected levy, the change relative to current law for the house, and then the same columns for the Senate, but also a column Senate-House difference. And so, you may want to look at the Senate-House difference column. That's the second column to the left of the gap that's sort of in the middle of the page, and then the last two groups of columns are the tails. So, for example, if you look on line 8, you see that the House has a $8,000 reduction in the equity levy, the Senate a $10,200 reduction in the equity levy for a difference of $2,200, and that the reason that line is changed is because there is a slight reshuffling of equity with the formula changes, so it's a real small amount, and the House formula changes are smaller, so the change is slightly smaller than the Senate change. Then on line 9, as I mentioned when we went through the aid spreadsheet, the operating capital levy in the House bill is reduced by increasing the equalizing factor and spending state aid in order to keep total levies statewide flat. And so on that line you see the House.
Representative Deputy Hedder.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Fabian and I were a little lost. I think we just caught up with you. Our sheet was in the wrong divider area.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's okay. We're fine. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Crow.
Okay, Madam Chair. So then that 17,119.8, that $17 million reduction is the levy savings that corresponds to the aid expenditure on operating capital equalization aid that is solely used by the House to balance levies, not for any policy reasons. And then line 11 is the levy impact of the taconite provision we talked about on the aid side, and you can see it starts in pay 2013 and then gets larger in pay 2014 fiscal 15. And then on line 12, again, we talked about the graduation exception for the math test being eliminated in the House bill in the final year of the four years that we're looking at. And so there's some aid costs from having those students not graduate and continue to be part of the funding formulas. And there's also a small $1.7 million levy cost in fiscal 2015. And that's actually the total cost and of the impact on a variety of general education levies. And then on line 13, there are fewer kids in the funding system because of the early graduation incentive that's in both bills. The House has a assumption of slightly more. Actually, we're using the same levy number here, just around 400,000. On the levy savings for this provision. And then on line 13, or line 14, the House scholarship program for enrollment options for tuition payments for students to attend non-public schools that are in first cities of the first class and with low performing schools, the savings of not having those students generate revenue under the funding formula is shown on that line, about $3 million in the current biennium. And in some cases, when you'll see a corresponding line. We do corrections. For example, if something does affect the first year of the biennium on the levy side and we can't adjust for it since we're already in that pay year, you'll see prior year adjustments down at the bottom where there will be an under levy or an over levy to compensate for a fiscal 12 change that can't be levied in fiscal 12 because those levies are already certified.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Crow, with regards to the line 14, the low-performing schools options, are we changing the resident pupil definition? Why is that number lower? The resident pupil definition still stays the same.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, this is levies, any levy that's calculated off of resident pupils is used for referendum. This is the non-referendum levies that use adjusted marginal cost pupil units.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Crow,
remember who's in charge. The referendum change is another small technical change related to the formula changes and changes in the formula changes because as the formula goes up, there's a small increase in the cap.
Madam Chair and members, on line 32, the Senate proposal, as we talked about previously on the aid side, eliminates the integration revenue program beginning in fiscal 13. The big savings on the Senate side of $28.1 million reflects the zeroing out of that levy. We'll see an adjustment down below because the Senate proposal under the integration of the literacy transition aid is calculated as an integration adjustment. So as Mr. Crow talked about earlier, we're going to sometimes see an occasional adjustment, and this is one of those occasions. Mr. Crow, did you want to speak to the House's integration adjustment?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair and members, this is another, you'll see some small ones that connect to there being fewer pupils because of the early graduation and low-performing schools enrollment options change, and this is one of them.
So, Madam Chair, on line 47, the Senate increases the career and technical levy, which generates an additional cost of $8.6 million each year, the tail dropping down slightly. And then, Madam Chair and members, on line 56, 57, 59, and 60 are a collection of levies that kind of work together. The Senate proposal has a provision that allows this was a Senator Bonhoff bill, and Senator Olson was a co-sponsor on this legislation, that allows the Wayzata School District early entrance into the alternative facilities program. In so doing, the school district essentially came and said, we promise to use pay-as-you-go levies. And what the Senate did is book a savings under health and safety and a savings under the health and safety alternative facilities portion and a savings under the alternative facilities aid portion, and then booked a cost associated with the school district coming into the larger alternative facilities program. So those items offset each other. They won't add exactly because there's also some additional savings associated with the salary freeze in health and safety, so there's some additional savings as a result of that.
And Madam Chair and members, on line 59 and 60 is the alternative facilities program and the pay-as-you-go portion of it, and in the debt fund, this first page is the general fund. In the debt fund, you'll see a similar pair of lines. The way we track the alternative facilities program is we track the total levy on line 59, and then we make a subtraction for alternative facilities aid on line 60. So the net levy for that program is the sum of 59 and 60. The House bill eliminates alternative facilities aid, so you see it's zero under the House column, which means that the net levy goes up $2.8 million in the pay-as-you-go portion of alternative facilities.
Madam Chair and members, both bills on line 63 allow the TIES program to levy on an ongoing basis for some maintenance associated with their building, and this carries a $632,000 cost. That was the Senator Olson bill on the Senate side.
Madam Chair and members, the changes on line 73 to line 93, there's changes through line 79. Basically, these are the changes that are the first year changes to the programs that we've already described in the cases where a prior year adjustment has to be made for levies already certified and paid in 2011. Madam Chair and members, then we move out of the general fund and into the debt service fund on line 106. The House bill has additional debt levy as a result of maximum effort school loan refinancing.
And Madam Chair and members, on lines 111 through 116, the Senate bill is tracking the costs associated with a collection of fund transfers out of the debt into the operating capital, and those are displayed along those lines. And Mr. Crow, I suppose we've talked about everything else in the debt side, haven't we?
Mr. Chair,
good point. On the extended day on line 165, the Senate is showing a slight savings there associated with the freeze, the salary freeze. There's some cost-based formulas there that would not increase, and the Senate is capturing that savings.
So, Madam Chair and members, on line 184, the total levies in each bill, you can see that the House minus current law levy change is a negative zero, so there's no change in levies, and the Senate minus current law is about $17.6 million, so the Senate bill as it stands saves about a little over $17 million of levy in the current biennium, and you see the corresponding numbers. A small $25,000 increase in levies in fiscal 14 for the House, a reduction of $19.5 million for the Senate in 14 and in 15, an $800,000 reduction for the House, and a $20 million reduction for the Senate.
So, Madam Chair, I think that concludes the levy tracking.
Very good. Thank you both very much. Then let's move on to the bill comparison summary. Some new voices here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nauman and I will walk through the Article 1. You can either look at the bill summary or the revisers side by side in the packet. They're both set up in the same way. The House bill, House File 934, shows up on the left, and the Senate bill, which is the unofficial engrossment of House File 934, will show up on the right. When there's no position next to that provision, that means the other bill doesn't have a similar or same provision. Also, the reviser has done us a favor and moved a few of the sections when the House and Senate put these in different articles of the bill. There's a few places where it makes sense to line them up, and the reviser has done so for us. So occasionally in what would be the House Article 2 or the House Article 10, you may see that next to a different provision in a different article so that it can line up with similar language in the Senate document.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I believe that the first provision on the side-by-side is a Senate provision under Article 1. This is the general education article. And Section 1 of the Senate bill updates the definition of income in the permanent school fund to include monthly earnings.
Madam Chair and members, the second provision in the House bill shows up on the left side of the bill and of the summary are two provisions that are tied to an appropriation later in the bill, and what these relate to is the management of the permanent school fund and the payments for the mineral management account. Under current law, a portion of the earnings from the minerals can be used for administrative purposes by the Department of Natural Resources. And what the House does in Sections 1 and 2 of its bill is accepts the permanent school fund from this provision, and later when we get to the agency appropriations, you'll see that there's a direct appropriation appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources in the same amount as they are currently receiving from the Permanent School Fund. So in essence, what's happening here is the Permanent School Fund's mineral payments are 100% turned into the body of the Permanent School Fund, and instead a line item appropriation will appear later for those activities.
So, Madam Chair and members, continuing on with the Senate bill, there is no comparable House provision for these. The Senate bill is going to have a collection of sections referred to that I'll refer to as the homeschool provisions. Senator Olson had a bill that was adopted by the Senate that, in exchange for reducing some of the non-public pupil aid that goes to homeschools, there is some reduced reporting requirements and some streamlining of some of the burdens. And this is the first of a collection of about six or seven sections that that what it does is reduce some of the requirements that superintendents are required to do for monitoring of the assessment of performance of students, and then adjust some of the information that is provided to students, reduces some of the occurrences when information must also be provided. Continuing on to the next page, we also have a collection of streamlining provisions to simplify the process of monitoring homeschool students.
Madam Chair, members, on page R5, section 3 of the House bill establishes a minimum length of time for the school year in terms of hours of instruction. It replaced our current standard, which keys off the district's days of service during the 1996-97 school year, and instead requires at least 425 hours of instruction for kindergarten students, 935 hours of instruction for elementary students, and 1,020 hours of instruction for secondary students.
And so, Madam Chair and members, as we talked about when we went through the walkthrough on the spreadsheet, both bills adopted part of the early graduation graduation achievement program, and as part of that, there'll be a collection of sections that need to be adjusted. The House will have a little bit more to talk about on the military side of this, but in the first section here, because under current law, there's laughing telephones. There is an adjustment made to the general education. When students graduate early, school districts are allowed to reallocate some of that money, and we needed to make an adjustment to that program. So when a student does graduate early and participate in the early graduation program, it's not counted in this statute. And then Section 5 of both bills, I believe, is identical. This is the actual operative language of the early graduation achievement scholarship. When students graduate early, they're eligible to participate. Depending on how early they graduate, if it's one semester or two trimesters, there's $2,500 that a student can use for higher education institution. Two semesters or three to four trimesters, there's $5,000 available. And three or more semesters or five or greater trimesters, the amount is $7,500. And Mr. Strom, am I correct? Those are identical, are they not?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, on page R6, section 6 on the House side is early graduation incentive for students that leave school early, graduate early, and enter into active military service. The provision here provides essentially a cash bonus to those students in the same amount as the scholarship that was provided in the earlier sections.
And so, Madam Chair, Section 6 on the Senate side is a continuation of the homeschool provision. In this particular section, we're clarifying some of the health information that must be provided to the superintendent, primarily immunization. There's some exceptions, and remove some of the annual reporting, and substitutes a first-year and seventh-year grade reporting for an annual reporting provision that existed in current law.
Madam Chair and members, Section 7 on the House side relates to, there are a number of provisions that are going to show up now that relate to our current staff development provisions in statute. In sections 122A60 and 122A61, the legislature has created both the staff development revenue program that sets aside 2% of the formula allowance and a whole series of staff development activities that are referenced elsewhere in statute. The House, while repealing the revenue, essentially kept in place the programmatic language in 122A60, and so you'll see a number of sections where the change is correcting the cross-reference, so it no longer refers to the revenue portion of that in 61. And you'll see those in Section 7, Section 8, Section 9, Section 10 of the House bills. Section 11 in the House bill. So up through the bottom of to the bottom of page R10, you'll see those provisions, and those are all related. Those are essentially a technical adjustment to the repeal of 122A61, but the House maintaining 122A60. Then, Madam Chair and members, Section 12 begins on the bottom of page R10. This is one of two sections that has to do with the treatment of revenue from the permanent school fund. Under the Constitution, that is required to go to the school districts of the state of Minnesota. Under the statutory language, that money is distributed on a resident pupil basis. What Section 12 does is amend the state's definition of school district definitions and includes in the definition of school districts charter schools as a type of school district.
And so, Madam Chair and members, Section 7 and 8 is some of the operative language associated with the homeschools. There is no change for any school districts, or any non-public school with enrollment in excess of 10 students. But for in those occasions where there are fewer than 10 school students per school, the education testing materials and the health and safety counseling would no longer be funded, and that generates some savings in the Senate bill. Section 9, flipping on to page R10, allows non-proficient student. This relates to the limited English proficiency program and was a governor's recommendation. It allows non-proficient students to use an assessment measuring emerging academic English to generate eligibility for the limited English proficiency program.
Madam Chair and members, Section 13 on the bottom of that page, on page R12, is the definition of general education revenue. The House adds a new component that we'll talk about in a moment called small schools revenue to the definition of general education revenue. Then in Section 14 of the House bill and Section 10 of the Senate bill, the basic formula allowance is established for future years. You saw these numbers on the spreadsheet as well. For the House, the formula allowance for fiscal year 12 is raised by $50 to $5,174. For fiscal year 13, that's raised to $5,210. And then for fiscal years 14 and thereafter, the formula allowance is set at $5,255.
Madam Chair and members, in Section 10 of the Senate bill, the formula allowance is increased by $50 to $5,174 in fiscal year 2012, and in fiscal year 2013, it's increased by an additional $50 to $5,224.
Madam Chair and members, Section 15 of the House bill refers to extended time revenue. This is the revenue school districts use for summer school and other activities that extend the school year, day, or week. You can see that the formula allowance that this keys off of is the formula allowance that was in place during the mid-2000s, the $4,601 formula allowance. That's being replaced with the current formula allowance of $5,124. Madam Chair and members, Section 16 is the creation of the new element of general education revenue called small schools revenue. Small schools revenue would begin in fiscal year 13 and would apply to both school districts and charter schools that have fewer than 1,000 pupils as measured by adjusted marginal cost pupil units. The revenue takes the formula allowance of $5,124, multiplies that by the pupil count, and then multiplies that by the ratio of 1,000 minus the district's pupil count over 1,000. What that ratio does is, as the ratio goes close to zero, that is, as as the pupil counts in those districts get smaller and smaller, the fuller that revenue amount is. A district with very few pupils would get about an additional $400 per pupil. A district with nearly 1,000 pupils would get just a few dollars per pupil. And you can see on line 9.23, the last part of this formula is taking 8% of the formula allowance as the amount of that revenue, slightly over $20 million a year beginning in fiscal year 13. Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, my apologies, and members, the next change on the House side has to do with delinking compensatory revenue from the formula allowance. Currently, the compensatory revenue reflects the $415 offset from the 2001 legislative actions. It's the formula allowance minus that number. That current formula allowance minus $415 is $4,709. So the House codifies that number in this section.
And Madam Chair, in Section 11 of the Senate bill, also dealing with compensatory education revenue, sets the compensatory program for fiscal year 11 only as the current program. And that's what's dealt with in paragraphs A, B, and C. Then beginning on paragraph D, the Senate, as we talked about during the spreadsheet walkthrough, freezes compensatory revenue beginning in fiscal year 12 and later at the total amount of the entitlement for fiscal year 11. It creates a calculation to prorate dollars up and down after an allowance is created based on the district's adjusted marginal cost pupil units. And then so if in the occasion that the existing formula front multiplying out the future year's pupils by the allowance that's generated in 11 would generate compensatory revenue entitlement that's in excess of the $414.2 million that members can see on line 9.26, if it's in excess of that amount, the amount is prorated down. If it's below that amount, it's prorated up, so it's guaranteed to remain at the frozen 414.2. Madam Chair and members, I'll mention on Section 18 of the House and Section 12 of the Senate are identical provisions. They both de-link the secondary sparsity revenue program from the formula allowance and holding law the 5124. So that when the formula allowance is increased in the bill, the dollars are not passed through under the sparsity, secondary sparsity program. That would hold also for Section 19 in the House and Section 13 of the Senate, sparsity revenue having two components. This is the elementary secondary sparsity, and it is delinked.
Madam Chair and members, in Section 21 on page R16 of the House bill, the House increases the equalizing factor for the operating capital levy by raising that equalizing factor. It's essentially reducing the operating capital levy by roughly $16 million. This is in part due to some other levy changes made in the House bill in order to keep the House levy target at zero. Section 22 of the House bill and Sections 15 of the Senate bill contain one change that's the same, and then the House has a different provision as well. If you go to the bottom of page R17, you can see on the House side on line 13.2 and on the Senate side on line 12.17 that school districts can use operating capital money to lease as well as to purchase vehicles. The definition of vehicle in current law includes school buses, so this would allow a lease of a school bus or a Type 3 vehicle for the school district as well. The second change that's in the House bill but not in the Senate bill is on the next page, on page R18. And if you look on the House side there, you'll see a new clause has been added, and it allows school districts to spend operating capital money for the costs directly associated with closing a school facility. Those costs include things such as moving and storage costs.
And members, before I continue on with the next Senate package, I'll call your attention back to the top of page R16. I think we inadvertently skipped over a provision. This is the sparsity, the provision of permanent law that relates to sparsity revenue for school districts that close facilities. The sparsity revenue is calculated in many cases, well, in all cases, based on a school's proximity to another, the next nearest school. And we've seen in recent years a few occasions where a school district neighboring Thank you. A neighboring district closes a school, and then that affects the calculation for the next nearest school district, often generating an elimination of sparsity revenue. So both bills adopt provisions to make adjustments to the permanent formula here, and then there's some additional language that we'll come to in a few pages that grant both Lancaster and Northland some exceptions and to use this permanent change. Then, members, if you flip back to page R18, section 16 on the Senate bill is the permanent statute governing the transportation sparsity revenue, and in the Senate bill, but not in the House bill, the transportation sparsity revenue program is delinked from the formula allowance, similar to what was done with the sparsity program. And Madam Chair and members, section 23 of the House, section 17 of the Senate includes the, this is the real, under permanent law, school districts are allowed to reallocate revenue from students that graduate early in 12th grade to for all-day kindergarten and pre-kindergarten uses. But because of the changes associated with the early graduation achievement program, if a student is graduating early, we would not want that money to be reallocated. So there's an adjustment here to this program to ensure that a school district is not reallocating and then having to pay that money out in a graduation achievement program. Both bills do that. The House bill is slightly different, as Mr. Strom spoke to earlier, because of the Early Graduation Military Service Award program. And then the open and standing appropriation for general education is Section 24 in the House and Section 18 in the Senate. We make adjustments to those formulas in very similar ways to adjust for the Early Graduation Achievement Program. And Madam Chair and members, Section 25 of the House, Section 19 of the Senate eliminates the $3 per pupil maintenance of effort to the Safe Schools Levy, and that was the MOE for the licensed school counselors. Both bills strike that provision.
Madam Chair and members, the next provision, Section 26 on the House side, shows up on page R20. This is the second part of the change to the school endowment fund money. As I mentioned earlier, that money currently goes out on a resident pupil basis, so it only goes to school districts, independent, common, and special school districts. This change would provide the revenue on an adjusted student basis, on a served basis, and because of the earlier change, it would go to charter schools as well as to the other school districts.
And so, Madam Chair and members, beginning on the bottom of page R20, section 20 of the Senate bill is the cash flow adjustment for permanent statute that allows school districts that have, under current law, 100% of their, a charter school rather, 100% of a charter school students that are special ed students are currently allowed to remain on the aid payment schedule of a 90-10 calculation rather than going to the adjusted 70-30 or whatever the percent happens to be. Because some charter schools have very high percentages of students that are special ed, the decision was taken last year to allow those, and that makes it difficult for charter schools to receive to build up a fund balance. The decision was made last year to allow those with 100% charter special ed enrollment to remain on the 90-10 payment schedule to ease some of the cash flow burdens. Senator Bonhoff had a bill in the Senate to make an adjustment to that to be at least 90% of a school's enrollment. And that is the change on line 15.3. The changes on line 15.6 through 15.10 attempt to correct for a drafting error that was made in last year's K-12 bill. This language reflects what we believe the intent of the conferees was last year, but through oversight we picked up the wrong language. Then,
Representative.
Mr. Dunman, you said there was a drafting error in last year's education bill. There was no education bill last year.
Madam, that's a good point, Representative. It was carried in the final bill that was passed in the special session. So it wasn't a formal education bill.
Right.
but it was the final bill that was included in the special session.
Gotcha. Thank you.
There were a few education provisions in that bill. Good catch. Good point. Section 20 of the Senate. Oh, am I skipping over something? No, I'm not. Section 21 of the Senate bill continues the homeschool provisions from Senator Olson's bill. In this particular case, we're dealing with some of the driver's license training requirements. Under current law, students must be enrolled in order to receive a driver's permit, and sections 21, 22, and 23 and 24 make adjustments to those to allow to accommodate the fact that that there are some reduced expectations on the part of superintendents, and essentially allowing the person in charge of homeschool instruction to issue employment requirements as well as driver certification for the purposes of allowing a student to get a instruction permit.
Mr. Chair and members, Madam Chair and members, the next two provisions found on the bottom of page R24 and continuing to the next page have to do with taconite revenue for school districts. A change was made a couple of years ago that essentially took the taconite levy money excess that previously had been applied against state general education aid, if there was any, and reallocated that to the city or town where that taconite was quarried or produced. On this, relatively modest amounts of money were involved for the last several years, as the taconite is calculated on a three-year average of the production tax. What sections 27 and 28 do is undo those changes from 2009, essentially reinstating the law as it was prior to those changes. The end result would be that as additional taconite funds come into the levy reduction category, if they're more than sufficient to pay for the school district levy reductions, the remainder then get reapplied to general education aid reduction for those districts. Those changes are accompanied by a session law change that we'll see later in the bill, but that's the sum of sections 27 and 28. Section 29, as Mr. Crowe mentioned, or as Mr. Nauman mentioned, is the same in both bills. This has to do with the Lancaster School and the effect on its sparsity of the neighboring school district moving its school facility. Section 30 in the House and 26 in the Senate are the same as well. These two provisions relate to the Reamer-Longville School District, which is now called the Northland Community Schools, and the closure of the Longville School for those districts.
Section 27, members, at the bottom, beginning on the bottom of line of page 28, is the salary freeze provision in the Senate bill that has been that we've made reference to when we walked through some of the revenue tracking. Subdivision 1 of the bill prohibits a school district or charter school from increasing salary or wages of any employee through June 30th of 2012. Prohibitions include the cost of living, steps and lanes, lump sum, and deferred compensation. Under paragraph B, employees transferred transferred to positions with greater responsibility may receive increases, and Q comp plans are permitted under the language. Beginning in subdivision 2, paragraph A, increases in contracts that are already in effect are permitted. However, new contracts with existing increases are excluded, and extensions to prior contracts are also prohibited. Paragraph B, beginning on line 20.9, voids contracts agreed to prior to the effective date of this section but are not scheduled to be effective until the effective date of this section. So then there's beginning down in subdivision 3, there are limits on the salary and wage growth after the expiration of the freeze, so increases cannot be backloaded. And then under subdivision 4, prohibits strike due to the refusal to grant a salary or wage increase. Flipping to the next page, subdivision 5 supersedes chapter 179A, which states that action under this section is not an unfair labor practice. Section 31 of the House and section 28 of the Senate are language that are carried in both bills that deal with the interaction of potential changes in the tax base in the tax bill. It requires the Department of Education to adjust equalizing factors and tax rates due to those changing tax bases so that we end up spending both the same amount of levy and aid. Section 32 of the House and Section 29 of the Senate are the appropriations sections. We dealt with all of these numbers when we walked through the spreadsheets. I think probably the most, unless Mr. Strom has something he wants to mention.
Madam Chair, members, I would just add on page R33 is the compensatory formula pilot project aid that probably didn't get a real large discussion when we went through the spreadsheet. So you may want to take a look at that. And otherwise, in the appropriation sections, we'll just highlight riders if they're different. So Madam Chair and members, so if you look on page R33, subdivision 10, this is the compensatory pilot project aid that the House is proposing, and you can see that the formula is listed there for the large districts and the additional compensatory revenue that they would receive. This revenue is all recognized by the districts in fiscal year 12, but is split by the appropriation split of 70-30 between the 2 years. Madam Chair and members, the next section is section 33, and this is the appropriation in the House bill to the Department of Natural Resources. You can see the amount of $2.07 million on line 22.17 on page R34 there, and this is the amount that would replace the estimated earnings from the Permanent School Fund minerals that would otherwise go to the DNR for administration and management of the minerals on trust fund lands. Section 34 of the House bill is the repealer and reenactment of the provision related to the 2009 law change regarding taconite revenue. So that accompanies those two previous sections that we talked about. Mr. Nauman will speak to the Senate repealers, and then in paragraph B on the House repealer, the programs that are being repealed there, 122A61 is the staff development revenue reserve of 2%. 123B05 is the late penalty for contract settlements, and 126C10 subdivision 5 is the the training experience revenue. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members, on the Senate repealer, section 30, paragraph A, are those two provisions are requirements that superintendents do visits to home schools. Those requirements are eliminated under Senator Olson's original bill. Under paragraph B, well, the Senate also repeals the staff development 2% set aside, but in addition, repeals the staff development program. That's 122A60. And then both bills repeal 123B05, which is the January 15th deadline. And that's a revenue item that we talked about during the spreadsheet. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 1.
As we move into Article 2 and beyond, I just want to remind everybody that we've got until 2:30, I think, the House that needs to be at caucus. So if we can be as concise as in the overviews, that will be very, very nice, because we'll be setting these with great detail as we go forward. So, who's going to start?
Just a request.
Representative Grafflo?
If you could let us go at like 2:25 or 2:20, so we have time to make it over to 2:17.
Oh, my. I don't know. Can we allow that?
I don't know.
Well,
I humbly grovel and beg at the chair's.
Who's going to begin? Ms. Lawson?
Madam Chair, members, in Article 2, Section 1 on the House side, this is a section from a mandate relief bill. It's to allow school boards to use interactive technology when convening meetings. Section 2 is also from the mandate relief bill that Representative Erickson carried. It has two aspects to it. One is to prohibit the commissioner from finally adopting revised and realigned academic standards and graduation requirements per the statutory cycle, and it also postpones by 1 year the timing for the review and realignment of the social studies standards.
And Madam Chair, members, the Senate section 1 allows for a career and technical education credit to be a part of the the chemistry or physics requirements starting the 2014-2015 or for students graduating those years, and also prohibits the commissioner from adopting the Common Core standards.
Madam Chair, members, Section 3 is a bill that Representative Downey offered. It proposes to reduce by 1 year the math grad exception. Section 4 is a bill that Representative Kiefer carried. It proposes to establish a number of high school assessments. These include a high school reading and writing high-stakes exam at the end of grade 10. The language lists the testing requirements for that grade 10 exam. Students would be required to demonstrate proficiency in both reading and writing in order to graduate from high school. In addition, it proposes to establish a high-stakes statewide end-of-course exam in both high school algebra and biology. Students would be required to demonstrate proficiency in both algebra and biology as a condition of graduating. It provides for a transition period if needed, and it proposes to establish benchmark assessments and an item bank as a way to provide intervention and support to struggling students and to improve instruction for all students. Furthermore, in that section, there is a direction to the commissioner to expand the assessment advisory committee. It would prohibit the commissioner from developing additional end-of-course exams in geometry, chemistry, or physics unless and until specifically authorized to do that. It would require that districts and charter schools indicate on a student's transcript the student's level of college and career readiness in reading, writing, algebra, and biology once those levels are established through professionally recognized methodology. There are quite a number of provisions that follow that come from a bill that Representative Peterson authored on teacher evaluation. They appear in Article 10 in the House bill, but they've been included in the revisor side-by-side in Article 2 to correspond with similar provisions from the Senate. So the first of the Peterson provisions is really from Article 10, Section 1. What it proposes to do is to require an annual report on students' growth and progress toward grade-level proficiency. This is important because student performance is a basis of evaluation. The next section, also from Article 10, requires that the student performance report card indicate teachers in each performance effectiveness rating category by school site. Section 5 in Article 2 is from a bill that Representative Myra proposed. It establishes a grading system of A to F for both schools and districts. It's a means to identify schools where students are achieving low, medium, or high growth and achieving or not achieving proficiency on statewide math exams. 50% of a grade would be based on the number and percentage of students who achieve proficiency on statewide reading and math assessments. 25% of the grade would be determined based on the number and percent of students who achieve low, medium, or high growth on statewide reading and math assessments in the previous year. 15% is determined based on the number and percent of students who achieved low growth and did not achieve proficiency on statewide reading assessments, and 10% would be based on the number and percent of students who achieved low growth and did not achieve proficiency on the statewide math exam. The proposal includes an appeal. It declares that the grades are non-public data until not later than 10 days after the appeal is completed. In addition, there is a school recognition award. It equals $100 per enrollee in each school district. The language establishes use of the school recognition award. These include one-time staff bonuses, expenditures for equipment and materials to help maintain or employ student academic achievement, to temporarily employ licensed or otherwise qualified staff to help with student academic achievement. There is a provision to allow the site team to decide how to distribute the award, and if no agreement can be reached, it is left to the school principal. There is the effective date section indicates that the commissioner is to use the student performance data beginning in the 2011-2012 school year to report a letter grade, and the school recognition awards are distributed beginning in the 2012-2013 school year.
And Madam Chair, members, on R13 is Section 2 of the Senate file, which directs the Board of Teaching to adopt rules requiring a person to pass instead of successfully complete a basic skills examination, and then they have to complete that before entrance into their teacher prep program. Then going on to Section 3 on page R15 requires the passing of an examination before getting an initial teacher license, and strikes some of the provisions allowing for allowing for a license to be issued before successfully completing the skills exam and renewals of that license. Then on section R16, section 6 of the House file, section 5 of the Senate file is the first provision for a qualified economic offer. They're quite similar. The Senate does allow for striking for non-economic issues.
Madam Chair, members, as Ms. Yunker indicated, they are quite similar. The reason for the difference between the Senate language that allows for strikes for non-economic issues and the House, which does not, has to do with proposals to declare declare teachers as essential employees, which would preclude them from striking, so that it would not be possible to strike for any related issue. Beginning here, and for quite a number of the sections that follow, you should be aware that they essentially, you will find duplicate sections, because we are amending both 122A40 as well as 122A41. In 122A40, we're addressing teachers in non-first-class city school districts, and in 122A41, we are addressing teachers in first-class city school districts. So many of these provisions essentially appear twice for that reason. In Article 10, Section 3, which appears now in Article 2, this is another provision from Representative Peterson.
Can you give us the page? We're moving here fast. State the page for it.
I'm sorry. R16, Madam Chair.
Okay. I guess I'm moving faster than you are. Okay, thank you. I thought you'd move me on that.
Yeah, no. It's the probationary period. Yeah. Madam Chair, members, this is part of Representative Peterson's proposal on teacher evaluation. This contains a proposal for a 3-year employment contract for probationary teachers. It would need to comply with the teacher evaluation structure being proposed. Only the first 90 days of a probationary teacher's first year of employment would be at-will employment. It establishes a basis for reviewing and renewing probationary teachers. It has three components: professional growth plan, appraisal results, and a performance effectiveness rating, as well as other locally established criteria. This would become effective in the 2014-2015 school year. In addition, there is language directing the establishment or creation of a professional development model for probationary teachers. The next section has to do with terminating a contract after the probationary period. Both the House and the Senate have language pertaining to this particular section. What is being proposed in Representative Peterson's bill is that a teacher who satisfactorily completes that first three-year period, then thereafter has a renewable 5-year contract. The termination for cause currently in statute would continue to apply. Again, this would become effective in the 2014-2015 school year.
Madam Chair, members, the Senate file has the renewable 5-year contract. In addition, it has a different date for the board to vote on whether or not to terminate a contract or to extend the 5-year contract. Also, the Senate file has provisions relating to if a teacher is terminated, whether they have a hearing in front of the board or go to arbitration, and the dates for those hearings and when they have to take place. Then, Madam Chair, members, Section 6 of the House file, Section 7 of the Senate file on R21 has deal with the criteria that the board looks for the terms of the condition of having a five-year renewable contract after that three-year probationary period.
Madam Chair, members, again, this is part of the Peterson teacher evaluation bill. It would require school districts to use a teacher appraisal framework that's described in a later section in Article 2 here to make decisions about both teacher development and performance. It requires ongoing professional development for teachers. Again, it gives a teacher who successfully completes a three-year probationary period a renewable contract. And then it directs school boards either to continue or terminate a teacher at the end of each year, each five-year period, based upon a number of criteria: the professional growth plan, appraisal results, the performance effectiveness rating, and other local criteria that are aligned to instructional practices in both teaching and learning. Again, this would become effective in the 2014-2015 school year. The next section has to do with professional development for continuing contract teachers. The language is very similar to language pertaining to the probationary teachers. The next section has to do with grounds for termination. It adds to the existing statutory grounds for termination a ground that essentially goes to a teacher effectiveness. School districts would be able to terminate a teacher on this basis. It also gives teachers 180 days after receiving notice of a deficiency to correct that deficiency. The next provision has to do with or includes technical changes. These technical changes would allow existing law to conform with the teacher evaluation proposal that is in this article. The next section has to do with unrequested leaves of absence. The proposal here is to give a superintendent discretion to exempt from the effects of unrequested leave of absence teachers who, in the superintendent's judgment, provide instruction that similarly licensed teachers cannot provide, or who have a subject area license that allows the district to meet unmet needs for student instruction.
The Madam Chair, members, moving on to R25, Section 10 of the Senate file deals with the immediate discharge and allows for the if a school board is going to terminate under the grounds of Subdivision 9, which was the grounds for termination in a prior section, if they couldn't do it by the close of that school year, they can do it under this provision just because of the timing. And then it also allows the board to to determine the teacher's salary and their compensation, and they can subtract that amount of payment made to the teacher during the 60 days of suspension. Then moving on to Section 11 of the Senate file on bottom of R26, again related to whether the teacher has a hearing in front of the arbitrator, and this is where they decide who the arbitrator is and the process they go through, and again more timing on when that hearing is held. And then more so on R28, bottom of R27, Section 12 of the Senate file relates to the decision either by the school board or by the arbitrator.
Madam Chair, members, if I could just refer back to the unrequested leave of absence section for one moment. I neglected to state that in addition to the changes to the language pertaining to superintendents, the Peterson bill also proposes to establish an order for unrequested leave of absence that has to do with teacher ratings, so that teachers who are rated as needs improvement or ineffective would be released first. Teachers who are rated as average would be released next. Following them would be effective teachers, then highly effective teachers, distinguished teachers, and finally exemplary teachers. The language also allows that the order for unrequested leave in cases of equal seniority can be negotiated, and the language retains the ability to retain a lower designated teacher as part of an affirmative action program. The next number of sections that are in the House bill are repetition of sections that appeared earlier, because these pertain to 122A40. So if you would continue on. It's page 33 in your side-by-side, and it's section 10, I'm sorry, article 10, section 17. R34. This is really the heart of the Peterson proposal. It establishes a teacher evaluation structure. That evaluation structure has three parts: a teacher appraisal framework, a mechanism for translating performance data into a five-part teacher effectiveness rating scale, and a four-tier status designation that would identify teachers as either standard, advanced, distinguished, or exemplary. In subdivision 2, this is part 1 of the appraisal framework. It uses performance measures and scores to create a 1 to 5 effectiveness rating scale, with 5 as the highest. 50% of a teacher's appraisal would be based on statewide assessment results if the teacher could be measured in that way. So, for example, reading and math teachers would be subject to this. Art teachers could not, because we don't have a statewide assessment in that area. If statewide assessments are unavailable, 40% of a teacher's appraisal would be based on district-wide results, and 10% would be based on teacher-developed assessments. If there are no district-wide assessments available, then 50% of a teacher's evaluation or appraisal would be locally developed, teacher-developed, and administrator-approved. The other 50% of a teacher appraisal or evaluation would be locally determined, but would have to include data from parent surveys, as well as 2 annual evaluations performed by a trained school administrator. In subdivision 3, paragraph A, you have ratings for teachers without statewide you have ratings for teachers with statewide test results available. It's a 5-point system. Teachers are highly effective if their students achieve 1.5 years worth of academic growth and a 5 on their performance rating. Effective teachers are those whose students achieve at least 1 year of academic growth on the statewide.
Larson, I don't think we need to get to all that detail. Okay. We're going to. Okay. We're aware of the bill. We heard that on the Senate.
Certainly,
side.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
So, if you wouldn't mind just progressing, so we can get a little further. Thanks.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I think that there's a Senate provision that got left over, so we'll let...
Madam Chair, members, just to turn back the page a little bit to R35, there's a Senate provision about requiring a 50% of a teacher's salary increase be based on student achievement.
Madam Chair, my apologies.
No.
So, Madam Chair, there's a paragraph that proposes to rate teachers who are not subject to statewide testing results. Subdivision 4 establishes a 4-tier status designation. Those designations are standard, advanced, distinguished, and exemplary. There is language to address teachers who are in between between 2 status designations. Subdivision 5 directs MDE, the department, to help school districts and charters collect and aggregate student data, and it makes individual student data non-public. Then there are a series of reports required, an annual local report or an annual report to the legislature, and an annual report that the department must make on teacher effectiveness, both to the Board of Teaching as well as to teacher preparation institutions. Then sections 8 to 11 have to do with QCOMP changes that are anticipated in it for implementing this teacher evaluation proposal. Section 10 actually applies to charter schools' QCOMP application, but these changes are to help anticipate the teacher evaluation process. Finishing with the QCOMP proposals in Article 10, Section 19, you have teacher effectiveness bonuses, also part of the Peterson language. There's a 10% salary bonus for distinguished teachers and a 20% salary bonus for exemplary teachers. Then come staff development proposals. These were also part of Representative Peterson's bill. As Mr. Strom and Mr. Nauman indicated, the staff development proposals in Article 1 are either to repeal one or both of the sections here. There are proposals to amend both the staff development program as well as the staff development revenue, again, to complement the teacher evaluation proposal.
The Madam Chair and members, on R46, on the Senate file, Section 16 allows for a teacher to receive a reading instruction stipend of up to $1,000 if they pass the reading instruction exam.
Madam Chair, members, the next section having to do with school administrator development, this is part of the House teacher evaluation proposal. This is the school administrator portion of the teacher evaluation proposal. It lists the model components for such a proposal. The next section, Section 12, is again part of a bill for mandate reductions. It would allow local school boards to determine the identity and number of vendors of federal 403B service retirement plans instead of having that part of the collective bargaining process. Then the next section, which in fact came from Article 10, again part of the teacher evaluation system, it would prohibit a school board from limiting the ability of a superintendent to assign and reassign teachers or administrators. The next section would make superintendents responsible for the annual principal evaluation. Again, this is part of the overall teacher evaluation proposal.
The Madam Chair, members, on R50, Section 17 of the Senate file allows a school board to establish a full-service school zone and the criteria that would allow them to establish that zone. Then Section 18 it allows for transportation because of the full-service school zone.
Madam Chair, Section 14 in the House is a program that would allow enrollment options for students at low-performing schools. It would allow a student who attends what is defined as a persistently low-performing school located in a city of the first class to attend either a non-public school or to participate in the state's open enrollment law. There are three alternative definitions of persistently low-performing schools. Participating non-public schools become subject to a number of requirements, among them meeting gender equity requirements in athletic programs, the State Human Rights Act, the ADA, policies against discrimination, harassment, intimidation, and bullying, accepting students on a random basis, and administering statewide reading and math tests. There is language to provide for payment of tuition. Essentially, the payment is to go to the parent, but the check is sent to the non-public school, and the parent restrictively endorses that check. There's language making the resident school district responsible for transportation within the district borders, and also a direction for the state to pay the non-public school for the cost of administering the tests. There is language that allows or that requires a participating non-public school to allow parents to review curriculum and to excuse students who find a particular curriculum or instructional materials objectionable. There is a requirement for an annual financial audit and a direction to MDE to list the participating non-public schools.
Madam Chair, members, then Senate file R55, Section 19, 20, and 21 relate to allowing 9th and 10th graders to enroll in college in the school classes for credit, presuming there's enough room after all the 11th and 12th grade students have applied and been accepted to that program. And then R56, Section 15 of the House file, compared to Section 22 of the Senate file. The Senate file, the operative language R57 at 45.28 allows for more than three now, strikes the restriction to three of the single purpose authorizers. And then on R59, going down to where it's 47.14, gives an additional year for authorized to charter school before August 1, 2009 to apply to the commissioner for approval to be an authorizer. Then, Madam Chair, members, the Senate file on R60, Section 23, is the charter school billing lease aid and getting rid of the grandfather clause for some of the charter schools. Then there's several sections, Section 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, stop at 32, change the Youth Works Act into the Serve Minnesota Innovation Program. Then Section 33 is a change to the career and technical levy. Then on R64, Section 34 of the Senate file is the beginning of literacy incentive aid.
Madam Chair and members, in Section 16 of the House bill, which is, begins on the same page on R64, the House eliminates the integration revenue program and instead creates an innovation revenue program for all school districts except Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. The revenue amounts stay the same in the same mix of aid and levy. For Minneapolis and St. Paul, the aid amounts are eliminated, and for the Duluth School District, both the aid and the levy amount are adjusted as the Duluth revenue per pupil is changed to the $129 per pupil that's in place for the other school districts in the state. The innovation revenue is effective beginning for the levies payable in 2012 and later, and for the aid in 2012 as well.
Madam Chair, members, Section 17 and a number of sections that follow have to do with changing the status of teachers. This Section 17 proposes to make teachers essential employees and thereby preclude them from requesting interest arbitration. Section 18 proposes to change the cycle for negotiating. It would allow teachers to meet and negotiate and enter into an employment contract between March 15th and October 15th in an odd-numbered year. Then it would suspend the negotiation until the three-month period before September 1. It would make employee compensation subject to the preceding contract during the time the negotiations are suspended. If the parties fail to reach an agreement in the even-numbered year, then the matter would be submitted to an arbitrator who would decide the matter based on a final offer total package.
Okay, before you proceed, you skipped a very important provision on the Senate side that on page 65.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, on the literacy incentive aid, it's comprised of proficiency aid, which is the calculation is on R65, and then also growth aid, which is the calculation for which is on R66.
Madam Chair, my apologies.
Apology accepted.
Continue. Madam Chair, it wasn't deliberate. Section 19 is again part of the proposal to make teachers essential employees. This would prohibit teachers from striking. And Section 20 is correspondingly strikes language that would establish conditions for teachers to strike. Section 21, again, this is part of the overall teacher evaluation process. It proposes to convene a group of experts and stakeholders to develop an annual performance-based principal evaluation system. A written report would have to be submitted to the legislature by February 1 of 2012. The next number of sections all have to do with reports that the House is requesting. Section 22 requires a report related to school and district grading system. That report would have to be submitted by February 15, 2012. Section 23 has to do with waivers for successful schools under the school of grading system. Section 24 requires a report to the legislature on low-performing schools. Section 25 requires assessment recommendations related to the proposals for the changed assessments. Section 26 is consistent with the proposed changes to QComp in anticipation of a teacher evaluation system, and it would require QComp DIST participants to submit a new application to participate June 1 of 2014.
Madam Chair, members, at the bottom, R71, there's a Section 35 of the Senate file, makes some schools ineligible for charter school startup aid because in the Senate file, the charter school startup aid is repealed. Then Section 36, the most of the language is on R72, is a cap for the literacy incentive aid. And then on Section 37 is a literacy transition revenue, which is related to the amount of integration revenue that the district received in fiscal year 2011.
Madam Chair, members, the next section that appears in the House bill establishes the implementation timeline for the teacher evaluation system. There would be a requirement to develop the framework and data collection system in 2011-2012, to implement a pilot program in 2012-2013, and to fully implement the system in 2013-2014. The next section requires the commissioner to look at the impact of a culturally, racially, and ethnically diverse teaching faculty on the outcomes of minority students. Also, district practices for recruiting diverse teaching faculty. These reports would have to be submitted February 1 of 2015. However, the study under paragraph A would not begin before 2013-2014. The next section establishes an 11-member task force to develop further recommendations on the teacher evaluation structure and to report to the legislature by February 15th of 2012. The next sections in both the House, Section 27 in the House and 38 in the Senate, have to do with appropriations.
I think that brings us to the end of the Article 2 and all the new reports, and
except for the repeal.
House bill. My goodness, I think you put in two for everyone that we tried to cut out. just an observation. But I think we will stop at Article 3 then and honor at least a half of your request to adjourn at 2:25 so you can make it over to the your caucus.
And just a quick announcement, Madam Chair,
yes.
If I can. I know I've had a lot of inquiries from the public. The conference committee will not be meeting on Friday or Saturday or Sunday. It's an open decision on whether we're going to meet or Monday or not. I'll work with Chairman Olson on that to figure that out. But just stay tuned for that. But nothing going on this weekend. And anyone else has any questions about that, you can see me. But if you come to me and if you heard this announcement and you forgot it and you come to me and ask me again, I'll tell you we're meeting at 8 a.m. on Saturday just to punish you for not listening. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks. Enjoy your weekend. Oh, getting adjourned.